As we get ready for worships to start, a couple of things. One, an invitation to remind you to put your phones in worship mode, and if you would like to help our sound folks out, just turn your phone off entirely. That would be great. And two, if you have announcements for the good of the order, make sure you write them down in one of the announcements books at the front or the back of the sanctuary, and either Debbie or I will read them when service is started. Thank you.
Good morning. Great. Welcome to church this morning. My name is Debbie Lovell, and I am currently serving the church as president-elect, and I've been a member here about 3 years. Everyone is invited to stay following the worship service for fellowship, conversation, and refreshments in our fellowship hall in the Kate Worker Room through these doors behind me. If you're a newcomer here this morning, we extend to you a special welcome and invite you to fill out one of the visitor cards found in the back of your hymnal. And if you'll put it in the offering plate or give it to an usher, we'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about any programs or activities going on here at church. If you have children with you, they're invited to attend our religious education program during the service when the children leave for classes later in the service. We do have a professionally staffed nursery for infants and young children. Adults are encouraged to attend the adult religious education programming at 11:50 this morning. If you would like to learn more about this church and about Unitarian Universalism, there's an information rack in our fellowship hall where there are pamphlets, newsletters, and other visitor information that you're certainly welcome to take home with you. Of course, we encourage you to speak with members to learn more and encourage current members to seek out visitors and share with them this beloved community. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. And now I invite you to turn to your neighbors and greet them, especially the ones that you don't know yet. I'm going to read some announcements that were submitted. If you want to stand while I'm reading your announcement, that'd be great. This one's from Sarah Johnson. Right there. We have a sign-up sheet for food donations for the Day of the Dead celebration fundraiser in the Kate Worker Room. It's a great way to contribute an item or two to keep our overhead down. Please see Kathleen for questions and sign-up. That would be Kathleen McKeever. And then from Sharona, there is no Unity Circle this month. From Yomi Kinder, for Dia de los Muertos, there will be a magic tournament for the kids or anyone who's interested. And from Mary Johnson about fair trade products, next Sunday, You'll have the chance from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. to purchase fair trade items through the Partnership for Just Trade. So, and now we begin our service with a prelude. Words of John C. Morgan. We are here that we might have life and have it more abundantly, so that we might share it with others. Come, let us join together as a generous people. As Gruvis Lucre lights our chalice, we share in the chalice lighting words. We light our chalice this morning, grateful for the love that we experience in this beloved community. May the flame light the way for all who seek such abundance. Our first hymn this morning is number 1010 in the teal hymnal, We Give Thanks.
How well do folks know this particular hymn? Anybody know
We Give Thanks? Oh, We Give Thanks, that one? No? Okay, then I will leave my microphone on. Please rise as your spirits and bodies allow. We will sing it through twice. Everybody.
Good morning, sunshine's
right. Yay. I used to wake up to that every morning from my mom. Good morning, sunshine. And I was usually a grumpy morning person, so very much, you know, the fog of this morning would be before me. So I welcome all here today of all ages and all walks of life. And I ask, I wonder what's in here. Any guesses what might be in here? Huh? Feather, okay. Glasses, nothing. Ooh, nothing's good. I'm not that tricky. Any other ideas what might be in here?
I'll give you a hint. It comes from the ocean. Sand is closer. Sort of like a fish, but not anymore. Sand dollar. Well done. In here is a sand dollar. Looks like this. Anybody have a sand dollar at home? Yeah. This is a special sand dollar. It comes from the Puget Sound in Washington State. Has anybody been up there before? Yeah. This is a gift from the former president of my seminary. She and her parents would go out to the Puget Sound and collect these. The reason why this is important is because today we're talking about a very interesting subject, money. I see. I saw a yucky face, I saw a surprise face, I saw smiles. Wait, what are we in for? Why did I come to church today? And what does it have to do with Santa? The thing is that when we talk about money in today's world, there tends to be a lot of baggage with it, a lot of negative connotations. What's money?
Things you can buy stuff with.
Piece of metal or a piece of paper? Any adults? What is money? The root of all evil. The love of money is the root of all evil. Abstract evaluation of our work. I have to really think about that now. Yes. I think I'll say it later today. It's what we use to trade goods instead of trading the goods themselves. Again, what does it have to do with a sand dollar? When I was in my internship, one of the wealthier members of our congregation, somebody who literally gave $25,000 a year, so a very large sum of money to the church, if you can imagine that. It was the most I had ever heard of. Very generous, very loving, very outspoken, and very comfortable talking about money. In fact, very comfortable talking about anything. You know, she'd have no problem talking about sex in front of hundreds of people, like just no issues whatsoever. That kind of a person. You know the kind of person I'm talking about, right? And she goes, Sunshine, you know that eye of the needle story in the Bible? I said, yeah. She goes, it doesn't mean what you think it means. Does anybody know what the eye of the needle refers to in the Bible? It's actually a place. The eye of the needle was a place where camels could not get through unless they got on their knees and crawled, and then they could enter into the city. In other words, what the text is saying is not that it's difficult inherently, just like it would be for somebody to cross through an actual eye of the needle, but that we have to be humble in our relationship to money. We need to be on our knees and comfortable walking into a new place with money. Money is, in fact, not the root of all evil. In fact, Unitarian Universalists, do we believe in evil? Kinda. Maybe not as, like, you know, we're all going to hell kind of stuff. We certainly believe there can be evil actions. So we come back to this sand dollar. This sand dollar used to be a creature that floated on the bottom of the ocean. Can you imagine just kind of floating on the bottom of the ocean? And what it does on the bottom of the ocean is if it gets moved too far, it swallows sand, which makes it heavier, so it won't float quite so far. It allows the sand to be something that grounds it, much like we need with our relationship with money, to be grounded, and to not see it as something that is baggage that's holding us back, but as sustenance that is allowing us to float through our daily journeys and lives. And so I invite you to think about your money like you do a sand dollar. Ladies. Like a sand dollar floating through the ocean. Just being as it is, either good or evil, but having such a wonderful power that thousands of years down the road, it may end up hands of a minister in front of a bunch of people in Altamont, Illinois, thousands of miles from where it began.
founded in the gift of life. And we have such a healthy relationship with our values, with our money, with our gifts and our resources. We understand that to be just as empowering and life lasting as this is. So with that, I invite our children and youth to go on to their classes, and I invite you to join in singing Rejoice, Love, and Be Unshared. The same music as we did with our doxology. Rejoice.
I invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any gratitude or celebrations you bring to the church with you this morning. There will be time to share concerns and sorrows in a few moments.
Still wearing my spiral painting clothes because I'm going back over there, but I just want to thank everybody so much who contributed their time and their talent and their treasure, and their food, and their back-breaking labor. For Spiral's barn raising, we're still at it, but I just wanted to really give a shout out. It's what I love about our community, how we step up and help each other. And it was meaningful, and it's gonna really help her have a winter where she can be warm and safe in her house. So thank you.
I want to share joy that marriage is legal in yet another 3 states this week. Huzzah.
I invite you to move to the microphone and share briefly any sorrows or concerns you bring with you to church this morning.
This is more in the form of an announcement. You may remember a couple of weeks ago, Claudia shared that her son's father-in-law had contracted brain cancer. Turned out it was a fast-moving cancer, and he died. And we went to the funeral yesterday. So that's behind us, and it's now a matter of moving on. Thank you.
I promised Dolores Ely that I would share that she is doing better this week. I think she's feeling a little lonely. She can't physically get here, and she hasn't really had much in the way of calls or support. So if you have some time this week, I'm sure she would love to just hear a phone call from somebody in the congregation. She's got some tests and other things to figure out and some decisions to make. So if you have any questions, please feel free to let me know.
May the gratitude and celebrations among us this day become a blessing to all, and may the concerns and sorrows of each be carried in all our hearts, a burden shared becoming a load lightened.
I invite you to take a deep breath in and out. And a deep breath in so your neighbor can hear you. In. One more time, in and out. I invite you to be present, to get comfortable. Yes, okay. To become aware of your surroundings, of the feel of the air, the feeling of the pew or chair you are sitting in, the sounds around you. I invite you to be in this moment, a rare time of silence in busy lives and busy weeks, to be open to the possibilities of a meditative presence. prayerful and contemplative space. And as you are in this place, with your eyes closed or open as you are comfortable, I invite you to listen to the words of Elizabeth O'Shaughnessy Banks about the interdependent web. Whenever life looks easy, know that it is more complex than it seems. The simplest, most profound pieces of art have exquisite planning. The melody line rises to the surface because it has been played out in the composer's mind, and the notes arranged and rearranged until all the intricate connections are designed for clarity. We see the web, the end result, strung on the front porch in the morning sun. We did not see the tireless spinning and weaving through the night, the near miss of the bat's flight, or the casual brush with the cat's evening prowl along the rail. And what we think we see is much less than what lives on in the depths. There is always more than what meets the eye. And so we ask for patience when we would wish for everything to be clear. We ask for insight when we can see no further than our own needs. We give forgiveness when others look into our lives and see no deeper than the surface of themselves reflected there. And we are humbled when we find we do little better and seek ourselves in others as well. In the quiet, we reach inward to that still place. I invite you now into a time of silent meditation, prayer, or contemplation, as is your own personal spiritual practice. As you feel comfortable, I invite you to join me in singing. The words are not posted anywhere. Just join in singing as you're comfortable.
Comfort me. Comfort me. Comfort me, O my soul. Comfort me. Comfort me. Comfort me, O my soul. Sing with me. Sing with me. Sing with me, O my soul. Sing with me. Sing with me. Sing with me, O my soul. Dance. Dance with me. Dance with me. Dance with me, O my soul. Dance with me. Dance with me. Dance with me, O my soul. Comfort. Comfort me. Comfort me. Comfort me, O my soul. Comfort me. Comfort me. Comfort me, O my soul.
May it be so.
From the book of Genesis, chapter 4. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. And from Reverend J. Cliff Christopher, why would we want to pretend that our financial lives are not a reflection of our spiritual lives? Our second hymn is number 16, "'Tis a Gift to Be Simple."
Today is a little confusing in that our offering will actually be after the sermon because the sermon's about money. So I invite you to please rise as your spirits and bodies align.
Thank you.
going to commit a Unitarian Universalist sin and talk about money. Actually, I don't think it's a sin at all, but it certainly seems that way at times. Every congregation I've been a part of has had to talk about money, and only one of them, out of about eight that I've been actively a participant in, did it particularly well. How did they do it, you may ask? Well, I'll come to that in a few minutes, but you gotta stick around. Before we can talk about how to talk about money, well, we need to first get into the nitty-gritty of why money is such a pain to talk about in the first place. There are a lot of reasons, and I could do multitude of sermons on all the different reasons, and I'm sure you wouldn't come to half of them. So I want to focus on what I think is one of the most important ones. One of the most significant reasons can be summed up in one word: shame. There is some degree of shame in talking about money. The shame is so great that few people who talk about money in the public square actually tend to go over the top when they do so. You can think of people like Donald Trump, everybody's favorite narcissistic man, or the Kardashians flaunting in every avenue of their lives all of the glamour and glory that they supposedly have. Or, as was announced this week, the ability to purchase $75,000 cologne. Extravagance is frowned upon, and people with money made out as caricatures of some mythological rich person who, quite frankly, does not exist. Wealthy people are mythologized as egotistical control freaks who only look after themselves. We come by this mythology from thousands of years of assumptions. Listen to these words of Aristotle. He wrote, "Wealthy men are insolent and arrogant. Their possession of wealth affects their understanding. They feel as if they had every good thing that exists. Wealth becomes a sort of standard of value for everything else, and therefore they imagine there is nothing it cannot buy. In a word, the type of character produced by wealth is that of the prosperous fool." Who would want to talk about money after that? It is not a surprise, then, that many wealthy young adults pretend they are not rich while in college. The shame of having money can be great. Actually, there are wealthy people who talk about money, and they do it quite well, but they are rarely lifted up as an example of health in our society. I think of Bill and Martha Gates, who utilized their money for important good causes. For J.K. Rowling, who gave so much money that she ceased being a billionaire. The truth is that having money is not evil, and the people who have money are not inherently bad in some way. They are not that mythological other that is so often talked about. Like all things, people are people. And it isn't the having of money so much as the what you do with it that might say something about who you are as a person, who you are as a spiritual person, even. One would think that with all the shame available for those who have money, that those without money would be lifted up as models of morality. Of course, there's more than enough shame to go around. Those without money are portrayed as inherently unintelligent, lazy, moochers who are dirty and without value. Young adults from poor families are equally likely to hide their status in college. The shame of not having money can be great. And then there are those who are in the working and middle classes who have just enough money to lead a reasonably good life, as long as they keep saving and they keep working. In this world, people live one or two paychecks away from being homeless or without a vehicle. You might even have enough to carry you on for some time, but the fear of being without can be equally tricky. Here, too, shame can exist. Shame over not having the right kind of clothes or car or Xbox games. The shame of having come from a family of poverty or wealth into the middle class. The shame of living comfortably while others suffer. The shame of having enough money can be great. Now, not everyone feels shame for money.
Some of you are listening to this and thinking, why would you feel shame about money at all? That said, I'm willing to guess that most everyone here, at some point in their lives, has had a moment of discomfort when talking about or dealing with money. It is woven into our society, and it is messy and complex, like everything else. We will scratch the surface of this today, and as we discuss the role of shame in relationship to money, and money as a spiritual and ethical aspect of our lives, keep in mind that shame is a feeling and not a fact. Let's talk about shame for a minute. One of the most alarming realities of our society is the lack of skill we have in speaking about emotions. We do not teach it, and we have not learned it very well. Unless you have gone to a therapist day in, day out, for weeks on end, you likely do not have the daily skills to be able to describe your emotions. Or maybe you're lucky enough to be a poet who can give you 50 shades of angry and sad. But for most of us, emotions can remain elusive. For example, there is a stigma around anger, particularly in the Midwest. And it is so extreme that we fail to recognize that there are degrees of anger. Anger is presumed to mean that you are loud, violent, and aggressive. What this actually describes is a variation of anger that could be described as fury or rage. Anger has lower levels, such as irritation or annoyance or frustration. Some of you may be feeling that towards me now. Not all anger is created equal. In fact, anger recognized at lower levels and met with self-compassion can prevent fury, rage, and violence. Shame is the extreme enactment of fear of lack of self-value. The best researcher on this subject today is Dr. Brené Brown. Do we have any Brené Brown fans in the house? I encourage everybody to at least go and listen to her TED Talk. She's spectacular. She's just a wonderful storyteller. She's fun to listen to. She is a licensed social worker with a doctorate focus on shame research. In her research, she differentiates between four words often used to describe the same thing: embarrassment, guilt, humiliation, and shame. You do not need to remember all four of those, but do pay attention to how shame differs from each one. Embarrassment is what you feel when you make a mistake or do something silly and can brush it off. It does not make a statement about who you are as a person. It happens to the best of us. For example, falling up the stairs or spilling coffee might lead to embarrassment. I know I've actually fallen up these very stairs and felt embarrassment. It is a low level and easily forgotten or made into a funny story down the road. You all have examples of that in your lives. For example, I was once driving across country and saw my very first mountain in Albuquerque. But I really wasn't sure it was a mountain because I thought they'd be bigger. I was embarrassed when I asked the gas station clerk if that was a mountain or not. Embarrassed, but not much more. Low level, so much so that I could share that story with you today. Guilt occurs when we make a mistake and we feel bad for having made that mistake. Religion speaks to guilt most frequently. And some of you may have Catholic guilt or Jewish guilt or, you know, all the varying kinds of guilt that are out there. That's not quite what guilt actually is. That's how religion has turned it. Guilt is just those times when you've made an honest mistake and you feel bad about it. And maybe you need to go and make amends or apologize or do something differently, take an action that will resolve that guilty feeling. Guilt is actually a healthy emotion that can be a guidepost to changing behavior in a way that allows us to live better and more whole lives. Humiliation occurs when someone calls you out or people laugh at you for something you feel is unfair. Brené Brown gives this example. A teacher calls out a child who has forgotten to put their name on the paper. Look, do everybody see this piece of paper? See, it doesn't have a name, but we all know whose name it should be there. It's Billy. Billy never remembers to put his name on his paper, does he? And the teacher humiliates him in front of the entire class. Billy can have one of two responses. One is humiliation. And in humiliation, he is angry at the teacher. And he tells his friends about it, and he'll even tell his parents about it, because he felt humiliated and that it was unjust, that it wasn't a fair thing to do. Humiliation, again, does not become an internalized dialogue about who we are as people, but more about how others treat us. Shame, on the other hand, makes a statement about who we believe ourselves to be. It is our deepest fear about ourselves turned inward. Take the story of the same child, Billy, forgetting his name on his paper. The teacher calls him out in front of the entire class. And he may likely respond with, "Yeah, she's right, I'm stupid, I'm an idiot. I deserve to be treated this way." And Billy doesn't tell anyone, because it's not news. Shame is not news. It is not a surprise. It is often not challenged because we assume it's just how things are, but it's simply true. Shame's greatest reinforcement is silence. Breaking the silence is its downfall. Shame has controlled the conversation for our society in many arenas. Why are so few rapes reported? There are a lot of reasons, but one is certainly shame. People believing that they deserved it or they asked for it. Internalizing the message of what others have said about them. A belief that if they speak up, it will only confirm to the rest of the world what they believe about themselves. That they are naturally depraved, deserving of what they have received. And of course, I hope we know that's not true. Why do people fear sharing that they live with mental illness? Shame that what society says about people living with mental illness may be true about them. Not being able to see that society is wrong. Silence helps maintain shame. And we see repeatedly the power of speaking out against shame in the civil rights movement, even in the actions in Ferguson. We see it in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer movements, in the women's movements, in so many places where people have spoken out and shared what is happening, risking all, being vulnerable, encountering the shame in their own lives. People who risk vulnerability for freedom from that cage are people who are known as shame resilient. You know those moments when you're shame resilient. It's when you disrupt that dialogue, you go to someone you really trust, someone who will hear you for what you are saying, and share that deepest fear. Shame resilience is the courage to share what is happening in our daily lives. It refers to a person's ability to recognize shame and use it as a signpost for personal healing and growth. Shame resilience involves embracing vulnerability and courage in one's daily life. Two of my favorite shame resilience experts are Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Any Macklemore fans in our house? For those of you who do not know, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis are hip-hop artists, perhaps most well-known for the song Same Love, which helped transform the social conversation towards acceptance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer peoples and their right to marry. Macklemore in particular writes songs that share his personal struggles with drug and alcohol addiction, as well as society's addiction to money and to things. His lyrics show vulnerability in the face of a world that might judge him for his ideals. In one song, he shares his shame at relapsing on alcohol. He meets a young woman who has found his music to be an important support to getting sober herself, and he writes, "If I can be an example of getting sober, then I can be an example of starting over." He recognizes his shame, but fails to let it control him and his life. So about that money. We have a society invested in maintaining shame around money. Shame around having it, the desire to have it, or the reality of not having it. Men are often expected to make money for their family, Any failure to do so is treated as a statement of the men themselves, rather than on the system that assumes that there will be poor people so that other people can have things. Shame helps us lose track of systemic realities. In other words, we blame the trees rather than looking at what is going on in the entire forest. Shame is painful. It's antagonizing and quiet, and frequently only exists in our own personal realms of awareness, unless we are willing to speak. When it comes to money, this often leads to a cultural value of silence. If we do not talk about politics, sex, or money, then we won't have any problems, right? Wrong. The silence leads to missteps and judgments that can hurt real lives. This congregation has had some difficult financial history. We've had difficult times with money and has seen the real impact it can have on lives. I must admit some anxiety of my sharing this particular story, but I think it's important for us all to hear. Many of you are aware that some years ago, a member of this congregation was convicted of stealing money from another member. This person ultimately took his own life. What a traumatic event for him and his family and for this congregation in its relationship to money. What shame existed there? What is clear in the retelling of the story that I've heard from many here gathered today is that no one really knew what to do in the face of this event. Cleaver even shared, not being sure what to do. How do we respond when such egregious acts occur? And what do our values tell us as Unitarian Universalists? Well, first, our values tell us one simple thing. There is no one right or wrong way to address this stuff. We wouldn't agree on it anyway. We can respond like a business would, but we are not a business. We could respond like society would, but we've already established that they don't know what they're doing. To move this a little further away from home for a moment, I think of the Enron people who kept scamming money again and again and again. Upon further research into the events, it was discovered that these were not inherently bad people out to scam money. However, the competitive and covert nature of their jobs led them to push further and further and see what they could get away with. It became a game. So far removed from real people and actual physical money, it became a game in which it was easy to dissociate from the impact of their actions. This is often the cornerstone of employee theft in businesses. The ability to get away with it, to rationalize it, and to access it. And in that world, where it becomes a game and it's not about real people, taking that money can become easy. And this is one place where Unitarian Universalist values can be helpful. We believe in the power of community. We believe in the power of beloved community. We focus not on what each person personally believes, but on how we relate to one another as a community. So how do we respond to those who commit egregious financial actions that break up relationships? Honestly, the first thing we do not do is keep the silence. We break it. We focus not on what each person, we first respect the inherent worth and dignity, and then call the people back into relationship with clearly defined boundaries and ramifications for actions. We strive for community always while respecting the individuals involved. The story of Cain and Abel gets at the heart of the confluence of what we have to offer the world. Cain and Abel give offerings to God, to someone they care about and from whom they want respect. God is impressed with one offering, but not the other, even though they both had worked hard to create their offerings. In this story, we see an age-old theme played out. We do not trade in actual animals or vegetables anymore. Instead, we use money. Yet while the means of trade has changed, the basic valuing of personhood has not. Money is seen as a translation of what we have to offer the world. When we have not, we can be like Cain and grow angry, shameful, and jealous. Here is the truth. Money does not determine worth. Your worth is not in your offerings. What would have happened if God said, I love you for giving what you can't? You are not your money. You are not a bad person for having or having not. Money is not the root of evil, nor is it the bastion of goodness. When we treat it in this way, we become like Cain, brooding and vengeful. My question is how God fits into all of this. What kind of a God fails to offer recognition for hard work? Another question is, who is God symbolizing in our own lives? When we have such an uncomfortable relationship with money that we cannot talk about it, for whom is God the metaphor? For you, it may actually be God, or it may be a parent or a friend who taught you to shame money. Or it could be an experience that was difficult and painful in talking about or transacting with money. We fear what we believe may be true about money in ourselves. And so what do we do about all this? We break the silence. We talk openly and honestly about money. We take steps to let go of the negative connotations and assumptions that lead to the class of society in which we live. Remember earlier when I mentioned that I was part of one congregation that talked about money well? It was not because there wasn't shame or struggle or difficulty in talking about money. It was because they engaged in a very simple spiritual practice, acting as if. But in other words, fake it until you make it. Important spiritual practice. Acting as if. When we believe or think something is true but are not quite feeling it yet, we act as if. When this congregation requested, the congregation that spoke of money well, requested a pledge from all members from the moment that member signed the book. They talked about valuing all money, whether it was $1 or $1,000 a month. They encouraged children to give a part of their allowance to the church. Fundraisers were loud and proud events where all people could attend regardless of income. A small trusted team of members, along with the minister, were aware of who pledged and how much, and were tasked with showing gratitude to all people for their pledges. Regular gratitude was shared for all financial gifts. Money was talked about from the pulpit and between the people. The language of giving and gratitude were used as if they were true, even if not everyone was quite there yet. And this was a Midwestern congregation, I promise you, they weren't there yet. Because people talked about money openly, it became easy to create checks and balances for fiscal accountability. No one person was left responsible for the money because it was clearly understood that the community, all of the community, whether you want to be a part of it or not, were stewards of their own resources. That congregation still acts as if today. As Reverend J. Cliff Christopher puts it, money is a reflection of our spiritual lives. As Unitarian Universalists, we do not believe in good and evil as such, so money cannot be evil, nor can it be an inherent good. We do not support the prosperity gospel that states God gives money to those who are good. We do not support a notion of money that is evil in and of itself. The way money is reflected in our spiritual lives is in the same way it is reflected in our personal relationships with one another. Our money is a statement of how we want to be together in all of our fiscal diversity. We provide for our families as best we can. We pay to support the work of the church as best we can. We give to organizations that represent our values as best we can. And we recognize that individually, we may not be able to accomplish much with our money, but when pulled together, it can feel good to give. And that, truthfully, is the best way to consider your pledge, your gifts, your time, your skill, your money given to this church, to organizations in your lives, to even to your own family. Give until it feels good. I want you to say that. Give until it feels good. This is also to help you wake up, because I've been talking a lot. Give until it feels good. Very good. There you go. Don't listen to the voices that say they will judge you because you are wealthy. There you go. Don't let fears of scarcity and loss hinder your relationship to the world. I'm not feeling it. It doesn't sound good at all. It sounds painful. Give until it feels good. Let's try that again. Excellent. I almost believe you. All right. Let's try that again. Don't listen to the voices that say they will judge you because you are wealthy. Don't let fears of scarcity and loss hinder your relationship to the world.
Give until it feels good.
Don't give until it doesn't feel good anymore either. You got it. Act as if your relationship to money is positive until one day it is, until it feels good to give what you can give, until it feels enough. Church is not here to make you happy. I will warn you right now, I have zero intention of making you happy. If you don't like that, you probably shouldn't be here. The people in this room do not come to this church with the intention of making you feel happy. If you don't like that, you probably shouldn't be here. That said, giving to a community that you love in good times and difficult times can feel good. It is our seventh principle lived. Our seventh principle states we affirm and promote the interdependent web of existence of which we are a part. Through the gathering of our financial resources, we help support that web. Through the gathering of our financial resources, we make this community possible. Each gift adding to the abundance of our beloved community. May it always be so, and
give until it feels good.
You lost some energy. One more time.
Give until it feels good.
Amen. Or blessed be, or whatever you're comfortable with. So with that, I invite you to rise as your spirits and bodies allow and join in singing hymn number 1021, Lean on Me. And you'll notice a word change to cousin for those of us. Oh, wait, stop, halt, desist. All that talk about money, and what did I do? I tried to pass the offering over. All right.
Looking at the overflowing cup, seeing from another perspective, witnessing life in all its fullness, we share from a place of hope and dedication and put our love into tangible form. This morning's offering will be gratefully received. May it be joyfully given.
Lean on me.
Yay. I invite you to turn across the chandelier and face your neighbors. Smile at them. Everybody deserves a good smile and a good wave. This is our most sacred community. These are the people to whom we turn in times of trouble and uncertainty. These are the people we come to practice what it means to be human. What it means to live with our shame and our anger, our joy, our celebration, and our thoughtfulness as whole, complete beings. For those within these walls here today, and for those who cannot be with us for illness, or for struggle, or because they just are exhausted, we offer our blessings and our gratitude. And so I say unto thee, give until it feels good. Give until it feels good to one another, financially, personally, thoughtfully, hopefully. May it be so.